Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander, and thanks again for joining us here with the Socialist Insight. Today we have John Strinka. John Strinka is running for the 39th District in Indiana, and he's going to be sharing a little bit about his campaign, what he is doing there in state government, and also we'll be talking about many of the issues that are relevant to all the 50 states. And John, again, I'd like to thank you for coming on and joining our program today. And John, I just want you to take a minute or so just to share a little bit about your campaign and also just introduce yourself, please.
Okay. Well, thank you, Stuart. It's great to be with you again. I'm John Strinka. I'm running for the Indiana State House of Representatives in the 39th District. A lot of people are unaware, but in Indiana, we've basically had kind of a radical right takeover of the state legislature. And what they've done in the last two sessions has been sort of a Wisconsin in slow motion. And that kind of prompted me to run this time out. I am in a heavily Republican district, actually something like 76% Republican, and so I've got my work cut out for me, but my opponent, Jerry Tor, was the primary sponsor of Indiana's Right to Work bill, and for those of you who are not real familiar with it, Right to Work is an invocation of the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act, and it's effectively dagger in the heart of collective bargaining. So it's basically is it's a complete stripping away of workers' rights for bargaining, and since the Democrats don't bother to run anybody against the incumbent Republican, well, I'm just going to let it go unchallenged. So so basically that's what I'm doing, and well, I'll tell you, it's been a long, what a long, strange trip it's been. It's been working on this really all the way since last year, and with ballot access and the rest of it. And well, here we are now with 9 days to go, 8 days to go if you don't count election day as day one. But it's been quite the experience. I think I've learned a lot about my fellow Hoosiers and kind of about the state of politics in contemporary America.
Now, Jerry Tor, he was in the race until you got in unchallenged.
He was unopposed.
What happened that unopposed? Why wasn't that? No
well,
Democrats
well,
even bothered
to
even
challenge. You know, it's interesting because with the election coming up, I kind of took a look at his past elections. He was unopposed last time, and the prior three elections, he took more than 70% of the vote each time, and then going back to 2002, he was unopposed there. But the reason he was unopposed, basically, is a function of the political system. What happens is that basically candidates, not only the president, but for small offices, are basically packaged and sold like products. And the point is when you have 76% of a constituency that buys the Republican product instead of the Democratic one, well, under a capitalist system, the Democrats don't figure that it's even worth the expense of running anybody against them. And frankly, that's what's happened. And again, the thing that really prompted me is the radical right agenda in the Indiana State General Assembly, the legislature, was really just over the top these last couple of years. The right to work was shoved through extremely arrogantly, no effective opposition. And personally, I can't stand to let somebody who's going to push such anti-worker measures through go unopposed. So a lot of the reason I'm running is to give people a choice. And unfortunately, in Indiana, it's not like California. This happens in a lot of our districts, given the way that Basically, the state house or the General Assembly draws its own districts. There are a lot of safe districts. It's done that way by design. And increasingly, given the cost of mounting a campaign, the party in the minority more and more just decides not to participate.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting things I kind of like to point out, and it was interesting, the local paper endorsed the candidates, and they did not have a lot to say about my particular candidacy. But in my response to them, I pointed out that the last time it was unopposed, and of course one of the reasons I'm running is to give people a choice, and just having a little bit of fun with with socialism, and as you know, we get called all kinds of things, and people don't really understand what we're all about. But I couldn't help making making the comment to the paper that there used to be this other country where there was only one candidate in an election, and that was called the Soviet Union, and it no longer exists. So hopefully we will be more successful in resuscitating our democracy, and that's part of what both you and I are trying to do here.
Now, one of the things in regards to right to work, and of course the Socialist Party USA, which both of us are members of the Socialist Party USA, and also I'm running as a presidential nominee for that organization, but the Socialist Party USA, what we advocate, the organization, is that any number of workers should be able to form a union, no matter what number of employees should be able to form a union within that workplace. What if it's a small business, a husband and wife, they open a business and they have four or five workers in the business? And this is a question I get from time to time, but what is your take, considering that you are pushing the right to work laws in a state such as Indiana? But what is your take on if it's a small business owner and he has three to five of his workers want to form a union? How would you deal with that?
Well, I don't really have a problem with that. That's an interesting question. In all the time, we've been going over the campaign, that really hasn't come up. And generally speaking, I think the reason it hasn't is generally if you're talking about a small shop where there are only three or four workers, something like that, in most instances, things can be handled informally. In other words, if the employer abuses his employees, they're going to be out of there because he's got a small business and he doesn't have the power that a larger organization does. And what I would think, and most small businesses, it's much more congenial. Now, granted, the business owner, of course, still still calls a shot, but in general, because it is smaller, the small business person is usually less inclined to run roughshod over his employees because he doesn't have that much more power over them. And this is a case where markets do function to some degree. Where you need unions, anytime you have a large number of employees, you're talking, 20 and 50 and up, and obviously with the corporate, monoliths that we have in the country today, you're talking tens of thousands of employees.
Right.
And obviously when you're in a situation like that, the employee has no leverage whatever. I mean, basically unemployment is very high. It's structurally high. It's kept that way by the system. So that if an employee is mistreated, he essentially has no recourse because he's dependent on that mass employer for the job, which is why unionization is so important. And generally speaking, in shops that have unions, you have union representation. They have basically collective bargaining, so they collectively bargain their wages and also the terms of employment. And unionized places not only tend to be remunerated better, but they tend to be a lot safer places to work, too, because,
right.
You know, work conditions and standards and so forth are also part of the negotiation. So, yeah, I mean, really, unionization is really the only hope that workers have to offset the massive, massive power that, that large corporate employers have.
Well, very interesting, because that question has come to me because I do support small business ownership. And if you look at another question that I receive quite frequently is people, they oppose socialism, and they oppose it because they really don't understand how socialism works. And
yeah,
here in the state of California, when you consider small businesses years ago, we have a department that's called the State of California Fair Employment and Housing, and basically that protected even the individual in a small business environment, where they had some type of recourse if the individual employer was doing something that was not suitable for fair treatment in the workplace, that they had that recourse where they could go to the State of California. And the state will look in, investigate, and take whatever appropriate actions. Now, if you go to try to take any type of action through the Fair Employment and Housing, basically you have to submit documentation, wait on long telephone calls, numbers that you need to call. But basically, the program has become very ineffective. What do you have there in the state of Indiana, basically, that would protect the individual rights in the case of employer small business owners?
Indiana is very backwards in terms of worker protection. Basically, on most measures of worker conditions, Indiana ranks down with the Southeast. We're pretty much at the bottom of the pack. Now, obviously, an employee can essentially act as a whistleblower. You know, he can report if the employer is doing anything illegal, all right? And
right.
Illegal things happen a lot. Now, not so much in the small business context, because, as I said, those things, in Indiana, anyway, are generally handled more informally. But as you go up the ladder, wage theft, for instance, is becoming an increasing problem. Now, again,
mm-hmm.
smaller businesses being kind of informal, you know, a small business person wouldn't think of ripping off his employee by and large. But particularly with service workers, hotel workers, people like that, wage theft is real. You know, it's happened.
It is.
They're ripped off by these big contract firms and
John,
forth.
And, John, could you explain how wage theft, how it occurs? Could you explain that to our listeners
it happens,
to understand?
It happens any number of ways. And again, it's the kind of thing that it's very difficult to prove. But, I mean, corporations such as Walmart does it, and a lot of organizations. But essentially, they will force workers to work overtime with
mm-hmm.
no additional compensation. They will force workers to work off the clock. In other words, you have, you know, so much work to do, and if you can't do that in a standard shift, well, you
right.
just stay till it's done, but you only get paid for the standard shift. And it happens a lot in terms of lower paid positions and service employees, because really the service employee doesn't have any recourse. I'll give you an example that happened just here in Indiana within the last couple months. Again, this I don't want to get too tied up with local specifics, but our hospitality industry is a major welfare recipient. Okay, I mean,
mm-hmm.
we with the Super Bowl being here earlier in the year, we had all kinds of constructions and new hotels, you know, the luxury things and this type of thing. And all of these places receive substantial tax abatements from the city, you know, the idea being that, well, they're going to contribute to the community. Well, there were no conditions set on how they could pay or how they could treat their employees, and consequently, what our city council tried to do was to essentially outlaw non-compete clauses in these employees' contracts. And what that is, to make it simple, I mean, the council used the word blacklisting, which effectively it is, but because of the way it's done, it doesn't fall under current blacklisting laws. But essentially what would happen is these workers work for agencies who then contract or sell their services to the hotels. And, of course, that prevent, you know, that allows them not to be paid any benefits and so forth, and also allows the hotels complete flexibility with scheduling. You know, if they don't want the people to work, well, then those people just don't work that week. Okay. At any rate, the situation that existed is that they had to the hotel and the contract firm that supplies the workers would sign a contract. And in it, it would say that the employee, the person working for the contract firm, could not be directly hired directly by one of the hotels for up to a year after they terminated from the contract agency. Well, in effect, the practical result of this was blacklisting, because the only way these people can work their way up or get a better job if it came open in the hotel is to go to work for the hotel itself. But when they go to apply, the hotel management tells them, well, we're prohibited from even considering you by contract. So at any rate, you got into kind of a long story there, but our city council tried to ban that practice. The mayor vetoed it. The city council passed it, but the Republican mayor vetoed the legislation. But one of the telling things is, of course, there were a lot of committee hearings for the city council and so forth beforehand, wherein the hotels were represented in force. And it takes a lot of courage if you're the employee to come and tell, the legislators about you know, what things are really going on. So what happened is one particular employee went to the subcommittee and testified, and 2 weeks later was promptly fired. And and of course the hotel's trumped up reasons for this, but her service record had been very good before that. There was no cause for it. She was essentially fired for having the audacity to try and protect herself at a public hearing. And that's the kind of thing that workers have to deal with, and that's why we need unions to protect them.
Right, exactly. John, I'm going
to
have you.
I do want to say one thing before we get to the next question. And I wanted to talk about the specifics. But one of the things you mentioned earlier when we kind of started the conversation was about how people don't understand socialism. And I think this bears saying, because there's a lot of things they don't understand. But I think it's important to reiterate that we believe that basically workers and communities should control their workplaces and their neighborhoods. In other words, we believe in a radical democratic structure where the people themselves make the decisions about their daily life. Now, one of the smears against us is that, well, you know, we're going to kill initiative and we want to make everybody all the same. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. What we're trying to do is to basically free people, you know, from material domination so that they can live freer, fuller lives. But particularly as it relates to small businesses, I mean, if a person has a small business, and he operates, within the parameters of the law, socialists have no problem with that. What we have a problem with is when businesses get large, what happens is there becomes an imbalance of power. I mean, the business can basically hire anyone it pleases. You know, the workers, particularly in times of high unemployment, are a dime a dozen, whereas the workers in the situation of having to accept whatever is offered, because his choice is, well, you know, work in substandard conditions, or literally, you know, don't have a house or don't have enough to eat. And I mean, so there's a vast imbalance of power. And when you're talking about, you know, small business, some guy wants to run a restaurant, you know, some woman wants to run a beauty parlor, something like this, generally speaking, those things can be done, you know, because the power isn't all on one side. They can usually be worked a lot better. But I think that's important, because when you say socialist, you know, people kind of growl and say, well, you know, you want to take away all our stuff. And that is not
right.
The point. What we want to do is we want to make sure that things are fair for everybody, that everybody gets a fair shot. And I just kind of wanted to get that in, because that comes up, you know, time and time again.
John, what is the minimum wage there in that's a question I have.
Well,
what is the minimum
wage? It's
the
federal minimum wage. So, I mean, you're 7 1/4.
So, yeah, the
now.
Federal minimum wage. And what? How have people received your message when you're talking about what the minimum wage should be based on what socialists are calling for? How do they receive that, the working person on the street, when you say that?
Well, the working person loves it. I mean, you know,
no,
they say, yeah. And I mean, a lot of it comes down to the experience. You know, I mean,
right.
You've worked your whole life for a living. I've worked in most recently, you know, at manual jobs as a warehouse worker and as a contract courier. And, you know, it's kind of funny if you look at the presidential campaign. You know, Romney, you know, talks to his moneyed supporters about, you know, how 47% of the people are, you know, free riders, and it's terrible. Well, number one, those people all pay taxes, because they all pay sales tax. If they're working, they all pay payroll tax, Social Security tax, okay? And the reason they don't pay any federal income tax is because they don't make enough. And I mean,
right.
so it's not that anybody's shirking, because these people pay a higher proportion of their income in Social Security taxes and sales taxes and property taxes than the affluent do, which is a disgrace. Okay, so that's number
right.
one. But number two, you know, the powers that be, the Senate, for instance, the U.S. Senate is a millionaires club. Okay, virtually. You know, the vast majority of the senators are millionaires. They have no idea what it means to work for a living. And, I mean, the thing is, if you just look at the basic expenses, you know, you really need, at least in Indiana, it's probably more in a lot of places in California, but in Indiana, kind of middle America, you need something on the order of $16 an hour to live. Now,
right.
the working people love it, because, I mean, as it is, I mean, most of them can barely, you know, make ends meet. A lot of them have to have 2 and 3 jobs. I mean, there's no time, you know, for a family. There's no time for anything but just taking care of the essentials. You know, the Republicans
mm-hmm.
like to talk about family values, but how can anybody take care of their family when every waking hour has got to be devoted to just, you know, paying your rent? You know, the biggest family value of all is giving people a decent wage, enough wherewithal so that they can take care of themselves. So the people like it. Now, we tend to get into, you know, into a discussion and so forth about, well, you know, where's it going to come from, and it's going to be inflationary and so on and so forth. And you can get into some pretty good theoretical discussions with that. But the point is, essentially, I mean, the distribution system in this country, you know, the wage structure has become increasingly bifurcated. It's going more and more to the top 1%. In
exactly.
the last 40 years, okay, American productivity has something like tripled, and none of that has come back to the workers. Real wages adjusted for inflation have been flat for 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, with the crash of 2008, they've actually been worse than they were 40 years ago. But at any rate, you know, the people really need to, I mean, there's something wrong with, and again, this comes back to our basic socialist, you know, precepts. There's something wrong with a system that produces for profit, because the logic of that means that they exploit their workers, that they just pay them as little as they can possibly get by, and that's not enough to live. What socialism does, I mean, we turn it around, and we look and say, look at, first, let's think about what do we need to make sure everybody is provided for, you know, and then we'll worry, you know, about the extra. Then we'll worry, you know, about the profits and the rest of it, okay? So it's a matter of fundamentally looking at it differently. And as far as it goes, you know, if you read a lot of economists, I'm thinking of Paul Krugman, who is by no means a socialist. He's a, you know, very capitalist, liberal economist. But he's pointed out that one of the situations we're in now is essentially a liquidity trap. Well, there's plenty of money out there basically tied up into corporations, but the money isn't coming back to the people in form of wages. And if you... you know, if you don't have money to buy anything, you can't have any demand. I mean, it's
so much
not
for trickle down, right? So much for that trickle down.
Well, and
doesn't work.
Doesn't work because it don't trickle. It all stays up at the top.
And, right.
And
now,
increasingly
I'm gonna
so.
I'm gonna have you to reintroduce yourself, and then we're going to get into several subjects here. We're going to be talking about the state's position on the death penalty, which it is a death penalty state. We're going to be talking about marijuana laws there in the state, also same-sex marriage, and a few other things. But, John, just take a few minutes, just take a couple of minutes just to reintroduce yourself, also the district that you're running for there in the state of Indiana. Could you take a couple of minutes to do that? Thank
you. Sure. Thank you, Stuart. Appreciate it. Well, my name's John Strinka, and I am running for the Indiana State House of Representatives in the 39th District. The 39th District is a comfortable suburb north of in the city of Indianapolis, and it is currently 76% Republican. One of the reasons I was motivated to do this is the last election out, the Democrats didn't bother to run anybody against the incumbent Republican, and they ran no one in the primary, so they didn't run anybody against them this year. And I just decided that, you know, when the current legislature does things like sponsor right to work and just really, really egregiously pushes anti-worker legislation through, you know, the people need to have a say about that. They need to have an election where there's a candidate, you know, who's clearly opposed to it, so the people have a choice. And that's essentially what I'm trying to do. And it's been an interesting experience. I've met a lot of people. There are a lot of people, you know, who agree with socialist principles. You know, a lot of people are not educated about what they are, but when you explain what socialism is about, you know, conceptually, that we believe in prosperity for everybody, not just a few, you know, we believe in taking care of, you know, everybody's necessities first, you know, they relate to that. I mean, we're basically, we're for the common good, we're all in this together. I mean, if we have an unequal society where there's a large number of downtrodden people without opportunity, no matter how well or how much wealth the rich have, the society overall is not going to do well. And that's the situation we're faced with in America, and I'm seeing there's more and more resonance with that. You know, people might not necessarily see it so much in terms of capitalism and socialism, but they can see in the last 40 years that our system has become very badly rigged, and it's time to make it fair for ordinary people again.
Right. Well, John, and we do appreciate having you to come back on this program. I might mention that this program is sponsored by Ruth Ann, she's with us today. And she's been very kind to work with the campaign to help to promote what socialism is about and also the various socialist candidates that are running for public office. Obviously, we can see in the more recent debates, even among third-party candidates, that even the third parties have have made it actually excluded the socialist candidates out of the debate. So when you consider that many of the third parties are saying that they should be included in the debates with the two big money parties, we think that what socialists are, what they have to say, not only in state elections, local elections, but our voice should be heard also on the national level as well. And also people, they want to hear what we have to say because they realize that it's very important. Change, we need real change, not the type of change that Obama, President Obama, was talking about in 2007 and the type of change that Mitt Romney is talking about today. Mitt Romney is very clueless as to what the needs are for working people.
Well, that's being charitable.
I may say he care less about the needs of working people. John, we're going to get into take a different direction right now, and I spoke to you earlier about before we came on the program about the death penalty. Of course, here in California, we have the death penalty, which presently we have 736 people that are sitting on death row. And there is a state initiative that is coming up in the election to repeal the death penalty and replace it with life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. Now, I believe that you do have the death penalty there in Indiana that you mentioned. Is that correct?
Yes, we do.
Now, what is being done there? And this is one proposition that I hope will pass come November, November the 6th, because presently in the last, if you go back in the last 20 years, they have executed 11 people, I think it's 11 people on death row, and the Los Angeles Times published an article, this was some years ago, that for those 11 people that were executed, it cost the state for the appeals, the housing, everything that was involved with taking care of that prisoner until the time the prisoner was, the inmate was executed, it was an average of $220 million per inmate. $220 million. So we can see that there's a very high price tag that capitalists, the capitalist ruling elite, and the prison industrial complex that they place on the state for executing prisoners. But what is being done there in the state of Indiana? As I mentioned, I believe you have a death penalty there. But what is your position and what are you doing?
Yeah,
or
well,
the state, I should
have,
say. What is the state doing?
Yeah, we do have the death penalty in Indiana. And, of course, I disagree with that. And I believe that the death penalty should be abolished on a couple of courses. Number one, and it's open to debate, but my view of the death penalty is that it's frankly barbaric and that a civilized citizen ought not to put its citizens to death. Even in the case where serious crime has been committed, incarceration and punishments such as that are appropriate. The idea, I think, should be primarily to protect society from a criminal, but that does not require executing the criminal. I mean, he can be put away. Now, secondly, the thing that is really scary, and again, I'm pleased to hear that there's a good possibility that the proposal will pass in California to ban it. Some time ago in our neighboring state of Illinois, and this was over a decade ago, Governor Ryan was the governor there at the time.
Exactly.
But, he ordered a review of death penalty cases, and you tend to hear this in large states because the numbers are just so huge. We have hundreds and hundreds of people on death row, like in California, in Illinois, in Texas, all large states. Now, proportionately, I would imagine our numbers are somewhere there, but because we're a smaller state, you just don't have these, hundreds and hundreds of people scheduled to be executed. So it doesn't have quite the urgency as it does in some of the larger states. But to go back to Illinois, what they found is, in effect, that that the state was wrongfully executing people. In other words, they were executing innocent people. And it was really appalling.
This was
when
in Indiana, correct?
Pardon?
This was in Illinois.
This was Illinois, yeah. Again, as I had indicated to you, and I think it has a lot to do just with the gross numbers, it has not been a subject of concern. Now, after we talk about death penalty, if you want to talk about, you know, the prison industrial complex, we've got a very bad problem with that of it here. But to confine the discussion to capital punishment, you know, most of what we've seen here came from the neighboring state of Illinois. And so the second reason, first, like I say, I think from a moral standpoint, executing prisoners is not a desirable thing to do. But more importantly, the fact that our system is so unresponsive, whereas, you know, if evidence comes to light that a person is not innocent, it won't get reviewed, and then that person not only sits in jail but gets executed for it. I mean, that is, you know, that is horrible to contemplate, and it's the most, you know, it's a gross miscarriage of justice. I mean, it's the stuff of nightmares. I mean, that is the kind of thing that should not happen in a civilized civilized nation. So it's that we can't have death penalty on the books because too many mistakes are made, and
too many
institutionally
mistakes.
Our legal institutions are not willing to redress those mistakes when they are made. You know, they'll
now,
go
it,
with
this,
the result of a flawed trial.
Has this been something that has been there discussed there in state politics as to possibly repealing the death penalty there, or repealing the death penalty there in Indiana?
No. Again, as I say, it does not have a lot of salience in Indiana simply because our numbers are so much smaller. Okay. In places like California and Texas, where you have literally hundreds and hundreds of people, on death row, which translates into dozens and dozens of innocent people on death row, it tends to get people's attention because you can see where innocent people are being executed. Brings to mind, again, this is a different area, but if you'll recall last year, the execution of Troy Davis in Georgia, and essentially evidence came to light. The entire case against him was trumped up. He was innocent. I mean, it was evidence
he was an innocent man.
And yet, because he was convicted, the state refused to overturn his conviction, and they executed an innocent man. And that's, well, you know, it's a horrible miscarriage of justice. We, you know, we can't allow that sort of thing to go on to happen.
The other thing that we have here in California, and the reason why I say here in California, because that's where most of my politics over the years where it's been, and also I live here in California, we have the three strikes law. And of course, the three strikes law, which came under Governor Pete Wilson, it has caused the prison population to explode here in California. And they're trying to do Proposition 36 to make certain changes in the law where certain penalties, especially if the third penalty wasn't violent, where it will not count as a third strike. I'm very much opposed to the three strikes law, period, no matter what state that is in, because the only thing it's designed to do is to make certain that they can replenish, the state can replenish the prison population. Here in California, at the time before they had the three strikes law, they had 11 prisons statewide, and then they had additional state funding where they built an additional 22 state prisons and went from 11 to 33 prisons. Subsequently, what happened is the prison population more than it was triple of what it was before they built the prisons. And the prison population went up to 173,000. So subsequently, they still had the problem of overcrowding. But do you have a three strikes law there in the state of Indiana, John?
No, we don't have anything, fortunately, like that in Indiana. That is a bad idea that fortunately has not caught on here. But
right.
it opens up the discussion, because what we don't have a three strikes law, but what we very much have is the prison industrial complex. And bear with me a little bit, because it kind of takes a little bit of explaining. But most of the prisons in Indiana have been privatized, all right? So that, number one, effectively, the government does not oversee these things, like they should. And the prisons are run for profit. Now, when you start to think about it, that's really unconscionable. I mean, what you've got there is a situation that encourages a gulag. And that is precisely what our laws are designed to do. Now, we're not talking, if someone is a violent criminal, a murderer, or something like that, he needs to be locked away to keep society safe. But that is not mostly who's going to jail. Mostly who's going to jail are people who, foolishly, overlooked something and caused property damage, people who puffed a little grass, minor drug violations. And in Indiana, most of the local justice system is very severe. So people get things like 5-year sentences, and they serve them, for doing things like puffing a little grass. And the point is that it has gotten to the point in Indiana where it actually has gotten some traction in our gubernatorial election. Now, it's kind of interesting. We do have a Libertarian Party here, and the Libertarians are interesting here. For the most part, their kind of standard national persona is they're very much in love with free markets. But we do have a strain of libertarians here in Indiana that are concerned about personal liberties. And in the gubernatorial debates, the libertarian candidate has pointed out time and time again that, incarcerating people for petty crimes, for nonviolent crimes, is counterproductive. We spend way more on imprisoning them than we would if we educated them properly, and gave them enough skills and judgment to, to avoid some of these minor crimes. I mean, effectively, what's going on, the United States incarceration rate is as high as in the world. I mean, we have a higher incarceration rate than they do in China, so much for our voluntary freedom. But
very
interesting,
John. We have 5% of the world's population, and we have 25% of the world's prison population.
Yeah, and a lot of that comes back to this, capitalist system, the prison complex, because what happens is that the operators, it's not run by the state, the operators are making a profit on these prisons, and it's very much to their benefit to make sure that, trivial laws are enforced. I mean, it's the whole tragedy of the war on drugs. All the number one, the law enforcement resources, that should be used to keep people safe are being used to prosecute harmless crimes. And then secondly, because the conditions in the private prisons are so bad, you can forget about rehabilitation. And basically, once you've gone through the system, I mean, the recidivism rate in the United States is incredible, because once you get out of that, it's very difficult to find a job. You have a lot of your a lot of your privileges are stripped from you. You can't vote in a lot of places, a lot of other things. It's just very difficult to get a job. I'll point out another thing, and this is kind of, it's happened in other places in the country, but what our governor here is very big on privatizing most everything, and of course they're trying to privatize the schools, and they've succeeded mm-hmm. some time ago in privatizing the prisons. But what we started doing is a corporation would operate Indiana Prison, and we would basically bring in prisoners from Arizona, and they would serve out their sentences here in Indiana. And if you stop and think about that, aside from, you know, the fact that these people are essentially being shuttled about for corporate profit, the thing that's really, really horrible, I mean, if you talk to any sociologist or any criminologist, okay, I mean, one of the keys to rehabilitating people is to have, build a social network for them. You know, a person has to have some kind of social support. Well, if you take right. somebody and you put him in jail 2,000 miles away from anybody that he knows, from his family, from anybody that cares about him, I mean, you're almost guaranteeing that you're going to have a bad outcome because you've stripped him of any social network, you know, that he could lean on to rehabilitate himself. I mean, so it's counterproductive, and a lot of people just don't see you know, how counterproductive it is. Most people want to be protected from the dangerous criminals, you know, violent crimes, and I certainly agree with that, all right? But more and more, basically, trivial laws are passed in criminal enforcement is being used for essentially profit-making prison corporations, and that's, you know, that's just wrong. That's really not that much different from a gulag, and it's really sad that that situation has gotten so bad here in the last, I would say, decade or so.
John, if you take going into the last quarter hour here, could you just reintroduce yourself? Tell our listeners a little bit about your campaign. I might mention that we have John Strinker. He's been on our program several times, and John is running for the 39th District there in Indiana. John, just share with our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thanks, sir. I appreciate the opportunity. Well, my name is John Strinker. I am running for the Indiana State House of Representatives. I was a state representative in District 39. And District 39 is a comfortable suburban district north of Indianapolis, just a little bit of a suburb of Indianapolis, is comfortable and 76% Republican. And one of the peculiarities in Indiana politics is increasingly, with the way the safe districts are laid out, that the minority party no longer bothers to run a candidate. So in the last election, my opponent, the Republican incumbent Jerry Torr, was unopposed, and there was no Democrat in the primary, so he would have been unopposed this time around, except that I decided that that wasn't going to happen. And the ballot access, of course, is very difficult in Indiana. I had to get, 444 verified signatures, which the verification rate is only about two-thirds of what you actually submit. So I had to, my gross number was 636 signatures, for which I talked to, you know, had to talk to a good couple thousand people to get that for ballot access. So I suppose one of the things is I have, you know, gotten the chance to talk to a lot of people in the district, and it's been a pleasant surprise to see that there are a lot of people who believe in the common good and simply believe that the Republicans are trampling it and they need a choice. So basically I'm running here for the Indiana State House of Representatives to give people a choice. Indiana, this last General Assembly, basically was sort of a Wisconsin in slow motion. They stripped workers' rights, collective bargaining, public schools, funding for Planned Parenthood and women's health care, some really, really, far-right agenda. And, I just feel very strongly that the people need to have a candidate that they can vote for to oppose that, because in so many districts in Indiana, there is no choice. It's, you know, it's one party running. So I'm trying to give people a choice. So that's a lot of what's going on here in Indiana.
Well, John, we really do appreciate that you as I mentioned, that you've been very open to joining us here on the Socialist Insight and also sharing what is going on in state politics, which is very relevant to all 50 states. John, same-sex marriage. This is a heated issue that's been across the nation, and state after state, some states have legalized, some in Washington is still opposed by the majority, if the majority of the members in Congress. But what is the state of Indiana doing in regards to the rights of couples, same-sex couples, to be able to marry?
Sadly, that is something of a hot-button issue in Indiana, and we on the left are fighting to try and prevent that. What has happened, and will almost certainly pass unless something drastic happens, but the legislature has introduced a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage in the Constitution. This is really just horrible public policy. The reason we fear it is because we have kind of a clumsy way of amending our Constitution here, which is good because it needs to be hard to change a Constitution. But the bill has to be passed by two consecutive state legislatures, and then it has to be put up to a referendum. It's been put it's been passed by one General Assembly. The next term it'll come up, you know, to a new General Assembly for its second vote, and after that it'll go to the people as a referendum. And unfortunately, because of the Republican propaganda, the Republican right is very strong here. The gubernatorial candidate is Mike Pence, who has made his reputation over 12 years in Congress by essentially opposing anything to do with women's rights, rights for sexual identity, gay rights, anything like that. So we're in a very dire situation in Indiana with that.
Has it been part of the debate there?
Well, this is very
gubernatorial election.
This is very interesting. The Republicans run away from it now. And it's not a gay issue per se, but our very own Republican senatorial candidate made a gaffe second only to the senatorial candidate in Missouri about women's rights, and that was, he said, well, all life is sacred, and even in the event where it happens through the horrible circumstance of rape, it is still God's will. Well, fortunately, that has adversely impacted his showing in the polls, because it showed people just how extreme he really is, that he said that publicly on a televised debate, and it made national news. It was so bad. But going back to the gay rights, we have, particularly in Indianapolis, we have a vibrant gay community. They are very active in the business world. They tend to do rather well, very, very active in the arts community. And it's just to me, it's unconscionable that the state should be telling individuals who they can have relationships with. I mean, that's absurd. I mean, the entire argument about protecting traditional marriage. I mean, I know, Stuart, I know that you have a good relationship with your wife. I've been married for 40 years. I'll tell you something.
Right.
I don't see how letting gay people legally, have their partners recognized legally is going to do anything to hurt my traditional marriage. I mean,
right, exactly.
Under ideal circumstances, a marriage is a partnership, based in love. And I mean, so the state is going to tell some of our citizens that they can't you know, that their love relationship can't be legally acknowledged. I mean, you know, that's nuts. I mean, it's simply incomprehensible. I mean, it's so benighted, and it's sad to say it is an issue. It is an issue in Indiana, and it's the scare tactic is that, oh, well, somehow this is going to impair traditional marriage. And for the life of me, I've never seen anyone who could explain how, because it's not true. But it's very frustrating in that regard here.
John, another issue which states are dealing with, it would be the issue of legalizing marijuana. And I believe it should be legalized more than just for people that need it for medical use. But what is being done there in the state of Indiana in regards to the legalization of marijuana? Or is anything being done?
Gee, I'll tell you, Indiana's coming off pretty bad in this hour. it's one of the reasons I'm running. You know, kind of deal with some of these things. But sadly, that has no traction here. It really doesn't. And again,
what about medical marijuana?
We don't have that in Indiana. We don't have provisions for medical marijuana and such. So it's not like like California.
So in other words, there's a lot of work that needs to be done there in Indiana.
Yeah, there's quite a lot. I mean, it's socially very conservative, and most people again don't really think about how laws like that affect ordinary people. There's this mentality that kind of lumps, takes the law, at face value. Say, well, if it's a crime, if it's against the law, it must be wrong, without ever stopping to think, well, wait a minute, if you do, drugs like marijuana, I mean, you're not harming society. I mean, you're just not. There's no reason that there should be criminal penalties for it. It's just absurd.
Exactly.
But
I believe in the legalization
of here.
Ruth Ann, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Okay, Ruth Ann, what I'm going to do is I want John just to get some contact information. And also, John, the two of us will be on Ruth Ann's program this coming Friday. So I would like for Ruth Ann, could you just mention that very briefly about the program that is coming up Friday, please?
Sure. Friday on the same station, Aaron Marte Field, John and Stuart will be on Feed Your Head at 8 o'clock Central Time. That's 9 Eastern and 6 Pacific. And it's going to be the first time we've done a two-hour show with the same guests. So we're going to have a lot to talk about. And in the second hour, we will take some calls.
And I want to say that Ruth Ann has been very beneficial for the Stuart Alexander Mendoza campaign, and also introducing many of the socialist candidates that are out there running for public office. They have not had the same opportunity as many of the third party candidates, and obviously the two big money parties. So, Ruth Ann, again, I would like to extend our appreciation for you making this available to the socialist candidates and
my
listening
pleasure.
To many of the alternative voices out there. John, could you just take thanks again, Ruth Ann. John, could you just give some information how people can contact you in this last minute or so, and then I'll just indicate how people can reach the Alexander Mendoza campaign. John?
Sure, I appreciate it. I have both a website and a Facebook page. A lot of good information on the website and links to to the Socialist Party USA. That is at strinkaforstaterep.org. All one word, strinkaforstaterep.org. And a lot of good information there. And the Facebook page, a little more casual, that's at Strinker for State House on Facebook. But the main vehicle is the website, and I hope you get a chance to look at it.
And thanks again, John. Once again, I just want to mention how people – well, first of all, I just want to reiterate that John and myself will be on this coming Friday, and that will be November the 2nd, and we will be on for a two-hour program, and that will be 9 o'clock Eastern Time, 6 o'clock Pacific, and we'll be on with Ruth Ann for that two-hour period. Also, to reach the Alexander Mendoza campaign, I'm running as a presidential candidate with the Socialist Party USA, and my vice presidential running mate is Alex Mendoza. You can contact the campaign by going to our webpage, that is StuartAlexander4President2012.org. That's StuartAlexander4President, that's F-O-R, President2012.org. And we look forward to having you to join us this coming Friday and also next Monday at the same time. Thanks again. Look forward to being with you. Thank you, John. Thank you, Ruth Ann.
Thank you.
Good night, everyone.